This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in to the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's BobbyKKraft. You're listening to episode 11 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Before we get started with our next interview on the Planet Microcap Podcast, I wanted to catch you up on what we featured on StockNewsNow.com recently. We published articles highlighting video interviews with the following companies: Nutrapharmacorp, NPHC on the OTC, CellSci Corporation, CVM on the NYSE market, RXI Pharmaceuticals, RXII on the NASDAQ, Cortex Pharmaceuticals, CORX on the OTCQB, Inovio Pharmaceuticals, INO on the NASDAQ, Rypatch Gold Corp, RPM on the TSX Venture, and RPMGF on the OTCQX, Immune Pharmaceuticals, IMNP on the NASDAQ, Minerva Biotechnologies, a private company, Water Technologies International, WTII on the OTC, Geovax Labs, GOVX on the OTCQB, Inspire MD Inc., NSPR on the NYSE market, and Naked Brand Group, NAKD on the OTCQB, as well as two Wall Street View articles, one by Seth Yakutan titled This Week in Healthcare and Life Sciences, and one by Lance Kimmel titled SEC Adopts Equity Crowdfunding Rules. We also published articles from the Microcap Review Magazine Summer Fall 2015 issue of Profiled Companies, Unified Signal Inc., UNSI on the OTCQB, and FinJan Holdings Inc., FNJN on the NASDAQ. So for this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Mike Schellinger from microcapclub.com. I was very excited to interview Mike because, like his partner Ian Castle, who we interviewed in the first episode of the podcast, Mr. Schellinger is a full-time microcap investor and has a wealth of experience that prospective microcap investors can learn from. In this interview, we discuss how he started investing in microcaps, his experiences with failures and success, how he finds new investment ideas, as well as discuss some of his articles he's written for microcapclub.com. What I took away from this episode and some things to keep in mind while you're listening is that there are similar trends amongst my guests. You know, understanding that investing in microcaps always requires due diligence and research, that you're going to make mistakes. And that's okay, because it's important to learn from those mistakes. Reading materials that other experienced microcap investors are also reading, and that developing your investing methodology takes time. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 11 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Mike Schellinger from microcapclub.com. But first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to StockNewsNow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
In this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I'd like to introduce Mike Schellinger from microcapclub.com. Mike, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
It's my pleasure. I've been following you for a long time, been following the Microcap Club for a long time. We had Ian, your partner, on our first episode, and I'm just so happy that, you know, you could find the time to come on and share your views with us. So to get right into it, let's start with your background and how did you get involved in microcaps and investing in microcaps?
Well, my path to get here is probably not a typical path. So my educational background is in computer engineering. I spent most of my corporate career managing software development for cell phones. And in the early 90s, I followed my dad into trades and small banks. So these were microcaps for the most part. And, you know, he would buy the stock, and then I would just buy the same stock, and I kind of learned a little bit from him. But basically in the banking sector for the most part. So in the late 90s, I decided I wanted to start selecting my own stocks. And the way I did it is I spent about 6 months learning and paper trading stocks. So what I mean by paper trading is I would pretend to buy something by writing it down on, you know, a piece of paper. And then I would, you know, I bought maybe three or four companies, pretend, and then I would see how they did. And after a while, I started noticing that the companies were doing well. So that gave me the courage to go ahead and open the brokerage account and you know, start trading for real. So fortunately, the way I started is I was looking at low PE stocks and I avoided tech stocks. And as we all know, this was the late 90s. And then in 2000, the crash happened. I got hit. But not too bad. 2001 through 2002 were slow, but I continued to learn and made modest amount of money in that time. Then 2003 to 2005 happened, and that was where I really started hitting my stride, and those were great years. And I started making more money investing than I did in my corporate job. And furthermore, amount of time, you know, I was spending maybe 20 to 30 hours a week on investments, and it really became, you know, impossible to do both my full-time job and do the investing. So after some contemplation in 2005, I decided that 2006 was the year I was going to cut the cord, and I did, and I became a full-time investor in microcaps, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
So how did you get into microcaps and microcap investing specifically? Can you go into that?
Sure. Well, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I started out a little bit in the microcaps just because that's, you know, the small banks is one aspect of it. But I think really what got me going in microcaps is I was looking at low PE stocks, which as it turns out, more often than not, not always, but more often than not, are microcap companies. So I just sort of, you know, stumbled into that, I think, in a way. But then as I went along, I started learning that, you know, one of the advantages of being in microcaps is that Wall Street basically ignores them for the most part because, you know, if you're a large fund, like, say, a Fidelity fund, you can't really buy a microcap stock because your fund is so big you'd have to buy the whole microcap company, and even then you wouldn't move the needle. So these microcap companies, you know, trade a lot less efficiently than their larger brethren, and that provides an opportunity, and that was an opportunity that I saw, and you know, that's part of the reason that I really like the space is you know, there's greater opportunity in this space for the small investor than you'll have, you know, competing against the fund that has a whole army of people, you know, that's managing billions of dollars.
How do you approach investing in microcap companies?
Sure. I'm mainly a growth investor, and my specialty is finding rapidly growing microcaps that I can purchase at a cheap price relative to trailing and or future earnings. So I almost always purchase profitable companies, and there's a reason for that is that, you know, you can make a lot of money also investing in unprofitable companies as, you know, as they hopefully become profitable. It's a lot harder to predict success in an unprofitable company than it is in a profitable company. So that's part of the reason I focus there. So my approach is that I usually purchase a stock based on news or some indication of an improvement in the business. And that could be that it's a company that announced an increase in their backlog, they get a large order, the company gave some great guidance, or there's some piece of information that, gives me a strong clue that there's going to be a fundamental change, or the fundamental change has already happened in their business. And so, I guess another way of saying it is that I'm looking for companies that are right at the inflection point. Mm-hmm. That is, I'm looking for companies where revenue and earnings are about to start escalating.
You know, you bring up something, a phrase that I remember reading in one of your articles on the microcapclub.com, where you distinguish the difference between a growth investor and a value investor. Can you provide kind of a detailed description of what the difference is and why you chose to kind of go down that road as opposed to value investing? Or there's probably some similar aspects as well.
Yeah, I think there's similar aspects. I think, I don't remember, I think it was Warren Buffett that made it, or somebody famous made a quote that I think they said all investing is value investing, so there are a lot of similarities. I guess what I would say is, value investing is more where you're looking at a company that maybe isn't growing so much, but they're just the price of the stock is really low, whereas a growth company is one where, revenue and earnings are really increasing at a rapid rate. But there's there's a lot of similarities in analyzing them, and some people choose to focus on one area versus the other.
Mm. So what is your due diligence process when you're analyzing a microcap company?
Well, my process overall is what I would describe as top-down. So I cast a very wide net. I don't know the exact number, but it's something like 13,000 of the smallest companies that trade in the U.S., so every day I'm looking at SEC filings and press releases for these companies, and I'm opening the ones up that look interesting, and I'm looking for, key things that will make it interesting for an investment. So that's really a big part of it, just, wading through lots and lots of data. I also use social media sites such as MicroCap Club, my personal network, and other sources. But a lot of it is really just, sifting through mounds and mounds of data. As I said, I'm looking for those companies that have a change in the results for financial results or news. And once I find them, I really try to dig into the company, read all the press releases, the SEC filings, website. And what I'm really trying to understand is, is there a new trend in this company and in the underlying industry? And I try to go as deep as I can. Sometimes I'll contact management when it's possible to really understand the company better. And I'm specifically looking for companies that aren't, one quarter wonders. I'd like something that, has the ability to grow for some time, whether that's 2 or 3 months, ideally years, but, it's hard to find a lot of companies, especially in the microcap space, that have that kind of time horizon. So the other thing that I do is, because I go over such a large number of companies, I keep research notes on the companies that I've looked at. So I've got my own notes on over 600 companies, and I find that those notes are really helpful because, I might look at a company in, say, Q1 of the year and say, the results are interesting. Maybe there's something here, or maybe there's just some, they got a big order from one customer that's never going to repeat, and that, that blip means nothing. So, I might look at it one quarter, and then, it's not until like another quarter or two when I actually decide that it's time to buy. And having those research notes is one of the things that really gives me a leg up on, from a speed point of view, because, when that next report that comes out, if it's good, it helps me to make a decision really quickly.
So do you have like an alert system set up for when, let's say that company, or do you put it like on a watch list, and then whenever that company comes out with some new news or their latest financials, it then alerts you and you check back in with your notes?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So how has your investing methodology changed over the years? You've been doing this a long time. I'm sure a couple things have been adjusted.
Yeah, there have been changes. You know, it hasn't changed too much, so it's probably more evolutionary than revolutionary. So, you know, in the first few years, I was looking more at low PE, and, you know, it wasn't for a little while, you know, a couple years into it, that I really started realizing how much I needed to focus more on the growth aspect. I would also say I'm probably more catalyst driven now than I was, you know, in the initial year or two. Certainly, I'm more structured in my approach. I have checklists I use to make sure that I've covered all my bases when I research. The notes that I take now, initially I didn't take any notes, and they were handwritten notes. Now they're, you know, computer notes on a form, so that's kind of evolved. I think the other thing that's probably one of the bigger differences is that I probably just see more risks now than I did in the earlier years. And I think that's just comes from experience of making mistakes. And, you know, you see something that happens in one company, and then the next time you see a company that's similar to that, you're like, maybe I should be a little bit more careful there. So there's probably a few more things, but sometimes they're subtle, and sometimes they're even, you know, as you evolve, sometimes it's hard to even see the changes that are actually happening to yourself. You may not always recognize.
So because you've kind of developed somewhat of a pattern and a methodology that's practiced and you've used it over time, you know, I guess maybe even taking from, let's say I'm the CEO of a microcap company. Mike, what are some do's and don'ts that I should do and shouldn't do when running my company that you would make it a little bit easier for you to start following and maybe eventually make an investment in?
Well, there's that could probably be a whole podcast right there.
I agree.
but let me try to come up with a few things quickly that might hit on some of the high points. You know, I think you have to be careful in how you manage the street, or manage investors. You know, set to the extent that you're setting expectations, be realistic in how you set them. If you set them too high and then you can't hit them, you're going to lose investors, and sometimes you're going to lose them for a long period of time. So that's one thing maybe I would hit on. You know, another is just, you know, manage your share structure very carefully. You know, manage the company well financially. So there's a whole bunch of different things, but you know, I think the other thing maybe I would say is, you know, I think CEOs should always put themselves in the investor seat and try to think about their company that way, and, you know, do what an investor would, you know, would want to see. And I think that's, you know, that's something that would help guide them a lot.
Okay, we're on to the fun portion of the program, and I was very much looking forward to asking this question. And so in the article that you wrote recently about the stock research in unusual places, you talk that there's virtually limitless ways of finding out about new trends that might lead you to a good investment idea. All right, Mike, you got to tell me, what's the most unusual place or source you discovered a good investment idea?
So probably the best story is that I have is the one that I've outlined in the article. I mean, I think a lot of people have some stories, maybe not everybody. So the situation was, it was around Christmas time, and my wife sent me to buy a gift card for my niece, whose birthday also happens around the same time. And she was in the second grade, and the store that my wife sent me to was called Justice. So I don't know if you've ever been in the store. This was the first time I had ever gone to the store. Had no idea what it was like. So I walked into the store. The store is filled with music and motif that was really attractive for girls of that age. And it wasn't like shopping at a big box store, like say you're in a Walmart or something. You know, every aisle pretty much looks the same. You got pretty much the same kind of sign on top of the rack. You know, this was really geared towards girls. And actually, when I was talking with my daughters who are grade school age, you know, recently, just before I wrote the article, I asked them, well, you know, how would you describe the environment? And they described it as glam. Well, I'm not totally up on all their terminology, but and the nuances of what that means. But, you know, the way they described it, I know they really like it, and they like it today. was packed, and this was during the market crash. So, you know, just seeing a packed store was kind of, you know, it was a big clue to me. It was one of those experiences where, just walking in the store, I'm like, wow, this place is different. There's something to this. So I went along, bought my gift card, and then went back home. And, you know, a couple weeks later, I was talking to one of my trading friends, and I told him about this experience. And he's like, yeah, my daughter really likes that place, too. So we're like, And we started studying the financials, like what we saw, invested in the company, and did quite well. In fact, it was just a matter of months later that the company got bought out by Dressbarn. So why am I telling this story, and why did I write the article to begin with? It's what I learned by this experience is, you know, I always try to keep my eyes open for new products or markets. So, and you know, coming up on Christmas time, this is a great time to keep that in mind. You know, so whenever my family starts talking about new products or services they like, I always go out and try to research the product, find the company that's selling it. Now, it may be a big company like Intel, and, you know, it's probably not going to move the needle, but every now and then you find something that's a small company that's publicly held, and, you know, you find a product that can really be, you know, a product or service that can really be a game changer for the company. And sometimes you'll learn things that way before the broader market really understands what's going on, and it's a great way to find small companies.
And what have you learned from both your biggest wins and some of your worst losses?
Oh, that's a great question. Let's start with biggest losses, because I probably, you know, I think most investors learn more from their losses than their wins. So my biggest losses have typically come when I made a big bet that didn't follow my system. So one case was a company that was marginally profitable. It wasn't really profitable the way I usually want, but I sort of stretched my rules a little bit. And this was during the downturn in the market that happened in, you know, the 2008 time period. And what happened is the company ended up having their line of credit pulled. And I also knew at the time I invested that their financial situation wasn't the greatest. And what happened is when the credit line got pulled, they basically couldn't finance sales anymore, and that caused the rapid demise of that company. So another example was a company that was had an early stage technology, and I thought the technology was further along than it was. Instead of waiting for financial progress, I went in big kind of early. And, well, it turns out the technology was harder to commercialize than they thought, and the stock ended up going down a lot, and I lost a lot of money. So the key, you know, I think really that I learned from my biggest losses is that, you know, I've got to follow my system. If I'm going to, you know, and sometimes you want to stray from your system to try something different to keep fresh, because maybe, you know, maybe there's another thing you can do a little bit differently, but you have to remember when you're doing something different to always start small, you know, before before you had a chance to prove out a new strategy, because, you know, you're going to be wrong a lot of times when you try something different that you haven't tried before. So it's good to start small. Mm-hmm. So that was the biggest losses. Now let's talk about the biggest winners. So I find lots of companies that I have the potential to be multi-baggers. You know, and what I mean by multi-baggers is these are companies that can double, triple, or more. Many of these do become multi-baggers, but not all of them. And I've had, I was fortunate to have one 100-bagger. I've had many 10-baggers and numerous companies that doubled and tripled. But one of the things I've learned over the years is at the onset, it's often very difficult to tell the difference between the one that's going to, you know, grow by 50% and the one that becomes a 100-bagger. One that was a 100-bagger, when I bought it, I wasn't sure whether it was going to be, the company was so illiquid, if I was wrong, I knew I was going to take a loss. It's really hard to tell at the onset, especially if you're buying them relatively early, which is when you get the, you know, you have the most potential. which one is going to be the winner, the big winner right away. While there's a lot of things, I'd sort of like to hit on two areas that I think are some of the biggest keys. So some of the really successful companies that I've owned have developed a moated business in a small area, and then they expand it to other areas. For example, there was a pharmaceutical company that had a product in one area, and they had a technique for finding these and commercializing them that was low risk, but they only had one product. I'm like, well, is this company a one-hit wonder, or are they going to be able to replicate it in other areas? Well, it turned out they were able to replicate it in other areas, but at the beginning, I didn't know. The other point that I'd like to highlight is that it really comes down to execution by management. Even the best business model in the world in a big blue sky opportunity comes down to execution. And you can get a sense by reading the management's bio, looking at their financials, how they manage the company, by talking with them. You can kind of get a sense as to how good or they are or aren't. But the proof is really in the pudding, and sometimes they execute and sometimes they don't. So given this with, kind of the two big areas where reasons that companies have turned into the big winner or haven't, I've kind of developed a philosophy that I like to have several companies in my portfolio that have the potential to be big winners, and then be flexible about my monitoring of them. I know that some are going to work and some will not, and I don't often know at the start which one it's going to be. I have my suspicions, and probably a little bit more right than wrong, but maybe not more than 55% right versus wrong on which one. But if you start with a good ingredient, you'll do well. But what I find is you got to have multiple opportunities like that, and then you have to have the wisdom and experience to know which ones to hold and which ones to cut loose, and knowing when to do that is really the trick.
And I'm going to ask, well, what is the trick?
Yeah, well, there's lots of things. Are they executing? Are they, is your original thesis coming to fruition, or is it, are you seeing cracks in that? Sometimes the challenge is, I think, knowing between a temporary setback and something that's more structural in nature. So sometimes it takes, you have to be patient, and it takes a little time for them to build traction. And other times, you can see more clearly that, this isn't a matter of time to build traction. So it's kind of one of those things, I think, that, comes a bit with experience and just seeing different scenarios. But you really have to kind of monitor their progress and know, whether your thesis is really intact or not.
Okay, so in this part of the program, we're going to take a little bit of a turn, because this article was one article that you wrote that it was a little concerning to me, because I was curious and didn't really understand and wanted to get more of an understanding about what's happening. So it's an article you wrote called "Proposed Regulations for Retirement Accounts to Impact Microcap Investors." All right, so can you set the table for our audience? What is the new set of rules that the U.S. Department of Labor is proposing, and how do these proposed new set of rules affect microcap investors? Should new microcap investors be worried?
Yeah, this is kind of a bit of a complicated area, so I'm going to try to keep this as high level. There's, typical government stuff. There's, piles of regulations, and I'm not going to take you through the details of that. But at a high level, the Department of Labor has a new set of rules with the goal of reducing conflicts of interest between financial firms and retail investors who are seeking investment advice. So that sounds like, great thing, something that it's hard to argue against. But like most things, the devil's in the details. So there's a variety of different ways that brokers may choose to move forward and implement these new regulations. And I have to emphasize that if they're enacted as proposed, because I think they probably will be modified a bit. But how this shakes out is, you know, is going to be a little bit hard to say, too, also because, you know, the different brokers will kind of react differently. But it's really going to impact IRA, and in particular, I think it's going to impact citizens who have self-directed their own IRA. You know, as it turns out, microcap investors who invest via the IRAs fall mostly in the self-directed camp. And so, as I see it, there's a couple of different scenarios that may happen depending on the broker where your IRA is located. And those three areas are, number one, you'll end up with higher fees. Number two, you'll end up with reduced tools and support. And number three, you know, it might be that you just can't trade OTC securities in that IRA retirement account. Let me delve into those a little bit further. So on the higher fees, what may happen is that brokers will be forced to handle you as more of a managed account where they charge you a fee for your, you know, to manage your whole account rather than charging you on commission based. And the irony behind this is that you know, this regulation is being proposed to help, you know, to a great extent reduce costs that investors have in basically paying their brokers. So it could actually have the opposite effect because they have to put you in a different type of account. Another scenario that you might find with a broker is that in order to avoid being labeled as a fiduciary, and I don't want to get into the details of what that means, in order to avoid that label and charge you the higher fees, as I outlined in the first example, they might be forced to reduce the tools and support that they provide. So that's sort of a way they can kind of get around this regulation. If they don't really tell you anything, then they're not responsible for anything. But unfortunately, investors lose because now they're getting less service. The third way that we talked about is just OTC securities, you know, will be banned in certain accounts, but certain brokers. And, you know, again, I'm talking about IRAs, so this doesn't impact your regular, you know, account that you hold outside of retirement, but it impacts your IRA. And, you know, I think this is kind of a scenario where maybe with a smaller broker you might see that because they just decide all this new regulation isn't worth the work, and they'll just say, well, if you want to trade microcaps, you know, you're just going to have to open an account elsewhere. So what does this all mean? You'll still, as far as I understand it, I think you will still be able to trade microcaps in an IRA. However, it's going to be more difficult to do that. And that's bad for, you know, those particular investors that are impacted, but also it's bad for the microcap space as a whole and the underlying companies. You know, I suspect that if this goes through as proposed, one of the impacts is these microcap companies are just going to have a little bit less interest and a little less volume because they're losing some of the people from the retirement space. So, as we're recording this, my understanding is they're still analyzing the feedback, including, you know, feedback that I provided them on behalf of Microcap Club, and you know, they're analyzing how they're going to move forward. So I think there may be an opportunity after they're done doing this analysis, they'll say, you know, what their next step is, and we'll either have another opportunity to give more feedback to the Department of Labor, or to, you know, quite frankly, to give feedback to our legislatures as well. So. It isn't over yet, but I think it's something that microcap investors should keep on their radar and, you know, do what they can as citizens of the United States to, you know, to voice their opinion.
Well, that's great advice, and thank you for going over that. We'll make sure to stay up to date as to what's going on with it and you know, what the DOL has to say with their feedback. So to get back right into it, and another article that you wrote that captivated my interest was the one that was called The Three P's of Investing. And the three P's that you outlined were patience, perseverance and psychology. And we kind of went through, there were elements of that we kind of already went over in this interview, but can we go through, you know, why are these important values when investing in microcaps?
Well, you know, I think this probably equally applies to, you know, both microcaps and most investing. You know, as an investor, you'll have streaks where lots of things go right and other times where it seems like nothing goes right. And, you know, when things feel like nothing is going right, it's often related to the macro situation, but it could also be related to other factors. However, I think if you have a good investing process, you'll see success, but, you know, you're just not going to see success all the time. And you need to have the patience and perseverance to take you through those valleys where, you know, the performance isn't what you would like. And when you're going through the valleys, you think there's a tendency to stray from your process, either by switching to a different process or maybe from just stopping doing your process. But you really need to, you know, kind of get up to the plate and keep swinging and have the perseverance, you know, to continue and kind of not fall off the wagon. You know, going through a down market is, I think, what often builds a good investor. It's easy to feel like a genius when everything is going up, but, you know, when it's going down, it teaches you some different things.
So would you say the fourth P is practice?
Yes. Practice is something that's really important. You need to practice your process and evolve it as necessary. You know, never stop looking for new ideas, never stop learning, and never stop doing research on your positions. One of the things that I've thoroughly enjoyed about investing is that there is this avenue to constantly learn about, you know, industries, products, investing, and what keeps it fresh and new each day. So it doesn't have to be boring, and I think just, you know, continuing to keep doing, you know, practice of investing and learning is, you know, what's going to make you a better investor. And you know, if you keep doing that, I think eventually things will work well.
And sorry, one last point on this article, and I'm really, when it comes down to, is psychology and understanding your own psychology. So can you comment on that too?
Yeah. You know, psychology is really important with investing. You know, as Warren Buffett says, we simply attempt to be fearful when others are greedy, and to be greedy only when others are fearful. Often in investing, you have to do exactly the opposite of what your emotions are telling you to do. You know, when your stock is going up, you know, you're thinking maybe, oh, it's going to go up further, but maybe that's the time you should be selling. You know, conversely, when stocks are going down, you know, it can be kind of depressing, but that's maybe when you should be buying. So being cognizant of your emotions and learning to master them is really important, because you have to do oftentimes, to be successful, you often have to do what feels uncomfortable, because it's the opposite of what your emotions are telling you to do.
So for new investors looking at microcap companies, what advice would you give them?
Well, I would say, you know, I talked earlier in the program about how I paper traded first. I think that was really helpful, because it helped me to learn what works and what didn't work. And it also gave me a little bit more confidence to know that when I was jumping in, I had an idea of what I was doing. You know, I would suggest also just trying to learn, you know, read books by famous investors such as Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch, whoever. One of my favorite books, I think when I started, I read like 3 or 4 books, and my favorite of all of them was Peter Lynch's Beating the Street, which I thought was a great book. There's articles you can read. You know, Microcap Club, we put out several new articles every month. There's lots of other sources you can get articles to. So just start, you know, reading about, you know, different investing strategies, reading about different companies in different industries. Just be a sponge and learn as much as you can.
And I wanted to ask you one thing, because this is something that I talk a lot about with my friends when it comes to investing in microcaps, and it has to do with your starting amount of money that you need to go in to invest in microcaps. You know, one of the things I juxtapose when it comes to investing in microcaps is like, okay, well, you know, these are cheaper companies that by no means that the value of the companies is any less, or, you know, there's not value there, but the price of the stock is cheaper versus, let's say, you want to go invest in Google. You know, so if your starting price with this was $1,000, you know, you can, it's not too many shares of Google you can own, whereas that same $1,000 can go a long way. You know, so from your experience, maybe when you were just getting started, you know, what advice can you give to up and coming microcap investors who are just curious, like, well, at what price should I get started at? Should I use a small amount and try it out? Or, you know, should I really save up a little bit, develop my strategy, develop my methodology, see what kind of works, and then start taking positions?
Yeah, well, you know, I think this kind of like all investing, you know, first, it's kind of similar in any kind of investing. So first thing, you know, investors should do is, you know, get your financial house in order before you start investing, you know, pay off those credit cards, all those kind of things. When you get to the point of investing, you know, it's going to depend on your financial situation. But I think it's wise to just start small, you know, maybe start with, you know, a small amount of money in a, you know, in a, and, you know, one company or maybe two or three companies. And, you know, you have to be cognizant that you're going to make mistakes when you start out. So it's always better to make small mistakes to begin with. And then as you gain experience, you know, deploy more capital and know that you know what you're doing.
So, okay. So speaking of Microcap Club from the answer previously, are there any new developments going on over there that you'd like to discuss?
Sure. Thanks for asking. So in the first episode of your podcast series, when you interviewed my partner, Ian Castle, he talked about the new subscriber option that we'll be introducing near the end of the year. So that we're getting close on that. Also, we just announced our first Microcap Leadership Summit, which is available for Microcap Club members and subscribers, and will be held in Chicago next year, September 22nd and 23rd. So the MLS will have a two-day format, with the first day being speakers, and the second day being presentations by the best microcap companies we can find. We have several speakers lined up so far, with more to come. So we have Sanjay Bakshi, who's a famous value investor from India. We have Paul Lounces, who's good at deep field-based research. We have Chris Mayer, who authored the book 100 Baggers. And we have Ian and I. So MLS will be a great opportunity for members and subscribers to hone their investing skills and research some great microcap companies. And, you can find out more information on the website if you're interested.
I'm so looking forward to this event. I can't wait to go just as an attendee to hear all the different panels and people speaking. And on that note, you know, just to kind of wrap up here, what do you see going on in microcaps?
Well, let me hit on maybe two things. So the first thing, and this is, you know, kind of a shift that I've seen happen over the past 10 years, and more particularly in the past 5 years, and that's that information flows much more quickly than it has in the past. You know, 10 years ago, I would post an idea out on social media, and I'd just wait for people to notice. You know, sometimes it would take days, sometimes it would take weeks, sometimes it was a month or two. And now, you know, ideas and information are being posted more rapidly. You know, somebody posts something out on the internet, and, you know, everybody knows it pretty quickly. So I think if you're going to be an investor in the microcap space, you really need to, you know, be involved with social media. You know, CNBC doesn't discuss our little companies. So the best way to really understand what others in the microcap space are talking about is by reading social media. So that's kind of a longer-term trend. Something that's kind of a nearer-term trend that I've seen is that PE ratios are over the past, let's say, 12 to 18 months in the microcap space are higher than I ever remember seeing them in, you know, maybe since the 2000 time frame, and I'm not even sure they were this high then. I probably didn't track things closely enough. They seem to have come down from where they were a year ago, but they're still higher, And I think that's a function of, you know, where we are in this. It's a long bull. We've been in this bull market for a long time, and it's also a function of the scarcity of ideas right now. You know, I don't think there's a ton of great ideas that people have right now, just in general. So, you know, that's kind of one of the other things that's happening. But, you know, like all things, this ebbs and flows, and, you know, next year may be a totally different story.
All right, Mike. So, in wrapping up, let's give a plug for the website and also where our audience can go and follow you on social media.
So the website is microcapclub.com. And on social media, you can find me. You know, I'm the articles I post on Microcap Club. You know, or if you're a member there, you can see the posts in the forum. You can also see me on Twitter, where I am at MikeDDKing. Or just at MikeDDKing.
So that's at Mike D.D. King, the Mike D.D. King. Mike, again, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. I really appreciate you sharing your views with our audience, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you all for tuning in to the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Mike, again, for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap Podcast. Stay tuned for the next episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, where we'll have our next week in review and have another exciting guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review Magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.